From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. It has been another contentious day on Capitol Hill today as Attorney General William Barr faces questions from members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is the first time he's been questioned in public by lawmakers since the release of the redacted Mueller report. Today, Republican Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham declared the Mueller investigation over and said he'd turn his attention to investigating the origins of the report. Democrats have been grilling Barr on his interpretation of obstruction of justice. Let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, who's been following today's hearing. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
So Lindsey Graham asked Barr a number of questions today, summarizing how he felt about the report and other issues. Let's take a listen to an extended clip here.
You would support an effort by Congress working with the administration to harden our electoral infrastructure?
Yes.
Is that one of the takeaways of the Mueller report?
Yes.
Do you share my concerns about the FISA warrant process?
Yes.
Do you share my concerns about the counterintelligence investigation, how it was opened and why it was opened?
Yes.
Do you share my concerns that the lack of professionalism in the Clinton email investigation is something we should all look at?
Yes.
Well, they sound like they're on the same page about a lot of things there, Tam. Give us a sense of what Republicans, first of all, have been trying to do today.
Not talk about the substance of the Mueller report. That's what they've been trying to do today. So Lindsey Graham, within moments of the hearing starting, was talking about Hillary Clinton and her emails. Graham was reading text messages between Strzok and Page. These are people who, if you follow the president's Twitter feed, you've heard about a lot. They are Justice Department and FBI officials that had a relationship and texted a lot of mean things about President Trump, but they were also involved in investigations. So in short, if it was something that could be talked about that was marginally related to the investigation or not at all related to the investigation, Republicans were asking about it.
Okay. And the attorney general was also talking today about something that's been in the news since last night, the four-page summary that he gave of the Mueller report and about the interactions that he had with Robert Mueller. We learned last night that Mueller sent a letter to Barr after that summary saying that Mueller didn't feel the initial summary fully represented Mueller's conclusions. Here's what Barr had to say about that.
I asked him if he was suggesting that the March 24th letter was inaccurate, and he said no, but that the press reporting had been inaccurate and that the press was reading too much into it. And I asked him, you know, specifically what his concern was, and he said that his concern focused on his explanation of why he did not reach a conclusion on obstruction. And he wanted more put out on that issue.
This is something that maybe we'll learn more about if Mueller himself testifies on Capitol Hill. But tell us more about what Barr had to say about it.
Right. It really felt like Mueller is the missing man in the room. There were just a number of questions throughout this hearing where Barr was asked what Mueller thought or Barr was recounting what Mueller said to him. You know, the real substance of it is a line from the letter that Mueller sent to Barr, essentially complaining that he had put out this summary of the top line conclusions. The letter says that he felt that Barr's summary did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of the office's work and conclusions. Barr, for his part, keeps saying, well, it wasn't a summary. He had a number of contentious exchanges with senators where he was like, no, it's not a summary. It was just the verdict. It was the top line conclusions. And as for the larger summaries that Mueller wanted to be released, the actual summaries, Barr said, once the Mueller report was handed over to me, it was mine. It was my baby, and I decided how I wanted it released. He felt he had to release some sort of top-line conclusions because of the political moment and all of the speculation, but he didn't want to release it piece by piece.
Okay. The Republicans control the Senate Judiciary Committee, but there are Democrats asking questions as well today. Here's the ranking member, Dianne Feinstein, asking about the president's efforts to fire Robert Mueller, and here's what Barr said.
As the report indicates, it could also have been the case that he was primarily concerned about press reports and making it clear that he never outright directed the firing of Mueller. So So in terms of the request to ask McGahn to memorialize that fact, we do not think in this case that the government could show corrupt intent beyond a reasonable doubt.
That would be Don McGahn, the former White House counsel. How did Democrats react to that and other things that Barr was saying today?
Yeah, there were a lot of furrowed brows and a lot of disbelief. In this case, and he made this argument several times, Barr was saying there's a distinction between calling for someone's firing and calling that they be removed because of conflicts, because then Mueller would have been replaced by someone else. That was Barr's argument. It didn't seem like Democrats on the committee were buying that.
And will we hear from Barr tomorrow before the House Judiciary Committee run by the Democrats? Do we know?
That remains a wide open question. As far as we know, the hearing is still on. As for whether Barr will actually appear at that hearing, there is still a big debate about how it will be conducted, who will ask questions, how many questions, how long. And for now, he has not agreed to show up.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, thank you.
You're welcome.
The sixth round of talks between the Taliban and the U.S. peace envoy to Afghanistan began today in Qatar, but representatives from the Afghan government are not there. President Ashraf Ghani is out on his own. He's holding a grand council meeting this week, a Loya Jirga, with more than 3,000 officials, warlords, and tribal chiefs. They're trying to hammer out a common approach to ending the 17-year war in Afghanistan. Joining us now is BBC Kabul Bureau Chief Shuaib Sharifi. He is in Kabul today. And Shuaib, as for these talks in Qatar between the U.S. peace envoy and the Taliban, remind us again, why isn't the Afghan government there?
Well, from the very beginning, since the peace talks in the last few months for the first time, when Taliban agreed to sit on a negotiation table, they said no to Afghan government. They're not prepared to recognize the Afghan government as a government, saying we were the government ousted by the Americans. And once the issue of the presence and the exit of foreign troops from Afghanistan is sorted, we will then sit with Afghans, still not prepared to sit face-to-face with the Afghan government.
So this is the sixth round of talks with the United States envoy and the Taliban. What progress have they made so far?
The fifth round of talks, the longest, almost it took 15 days, starting late February till mid-March, discussing the issue of exit of foreign troops, including American troops from Afghanistan, and the Americans demanding a guarantee from the Taliban that the Afghan soil is not and will not be used against others. Those 15 days of talks didn't end with a breakthrough. At the end, they said, okay, we still need time to discuss a draft agreement with our leaders, a very detailed one. And it took almost 2 months now that they are back on the table. It's hope that this time they will at least agree on some of these terms. And a Taliban source told me today that they have discussed the details and they are optimistic that this time on the issue of the timetable of the exit of American and foreign troops from Afghanistan, they will have a breakthrough with the Americans.
Okay, now technically, the United States government backs the Afghan president. Does Ghani feel betrayed that the U.S. peace envoy is talking to the Taliban without the Afghan government being involved? How does he feel about this?
Well, somehow they did feel, and even they expressed that through the Afghanistan's national security advisor to the president a few months ago in the U.S. But for peace, all sides, including the Afghan government, appreciates the fact that there should be compromises. The Taliban clearly say we have our issue with Americans and it's right to talk to the Americans about the exit of foreign troops. We will then sit with the Afghans, intra-Afghan talks, talking to the Afghans, referring to the political parties, political leaders. And if anyone from the Afghan government sits on the negotiation table of intra-Afghan talks, he or she will be sitting as an Afghan, not representing the Afghan government. And perhaps that is one of the reasons that the Afghan government has called its own Loya Jirga in Kabul, as you pointed out.
And the spring fighting season is underway. So as all of this talking
is
happening,
yes,
there is bloodshed still happening. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, Peter, as we speak, in fact, there are over a dozen of front lines hot, both the Afghan government, Afghan security forces, backed by the Americans mostly, air support, and the Taliban are engaged across the country. And as we speak, at least on average, 100 a day get killed on both sides of the front line. So it's the climax of the spring offensive, and at the same time, somehow in the last few months, the climax of efforts for making some sort of tangible progress towards peace. And it's hoped that at least in the long term, or sometime this year, there will be some sort of a ceasefire across the country.
That's the BBC Kabul Bureau Chief Shuaib Sharifi. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The U.S. government collects a lot of statistics. So do state governments, city governments, county governments, and on and on. The problem is, if you want to use those statistics to make a decision about some important policy, they're not all in one place. That's where former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer comes in. He's founded an organization called USA Facts to put all the numbers together in one place, and they've just released their annual report. In the latest in our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top, Steve Ballmer joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Jeremy.
I mean, first of all, just tell us why you started USA Facts and what the mission is.
Well, I started USA Facts because I wanted to understand by the numbers, because numbers, to me, tell an accurate story. I wanted to understand what government was doing, where the money was coming from, what it was being spent on, and what kind of outcomes government was getting. And there was no consolidated view. You know, state and local and federal government probably need to be consolidated. Medicaid, for example, is distributed. So I decided it made sense to look at these holistically. And I wanted a report like corporations put out, a 10-K report to the Securities and Exchange Commission, just factual, past numbers, no future forecasts, no floweriness that describe the operation of government in its entirety, just like a corporation would have to put out. Obviously, the goal is not profit. It's positive outcomes for the citizens. And there was just no way to find such a thing. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to start this because I'm interested. And then as we went along, we had the whole, you know, alternate facts, fake news thing. Numbers are nonpartisan, and we only use government numbers, so nobody can say we're cooking the books. Mm-hmm. People can have their own opinions about what to do about them, but it really troubles me when people say things that are just not true by the numbers, or where they take a number out of context to try to dramatize a point.
Well, and according to your report, there are more than 90,000 governments in the United States. That includes state governments, territories, counties, cities, towns, school districts. Do you think it has been possible to actually put it all together in one place and have it make sense and give people some guidance about what to do?
Yeah, I do think so. There's a number of, I'll call them federal statistical agencies that collect the data and bring it together. The real problem is its currency, its recentness is not always the best. If you really want to look at things in aggregate, it's generally about 2 years old, mm-hmm. Because the consolidation of state and local spending, which the Census Bureau does statistically, is still 2 years late. So there's a set of things which could be more timely, but there's reporting frameworks from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the Treasury, the Census, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as we try to do state outcomes and local outcomes, that'll become trickier because there's no standard reporting, and the reporting in general at the state and local level is less good than the federal level.
Well, I've been looking through your new report, and it's pretty fascinating, actually, some of the details in there, things that you hear about but you don't really think about in detail, and you don't figure out exactly what's happening. One of the things is there are a lot of people in this country who are first-generation Americans right now.
That's right. The percentage of our population that's foreign-born is between 13 and 14%, which is historically towards the top end, but it's not the highest it's been in history. The other thing I think that's interesting about that is if you look at growth in our population, which is about 2 million a year, half of it comes from immigration and half of it comes because current Americans are having more children than the number of people who are dying every mm-hmm. year. But to see economic – part of economic growth comes from population growth, and half of that comes through immigration.
What else stands out to you in this report?
The notion that more people are living alone and more people are getting older. The older point I think a lot of people have in their head, and you can see the numbers on that in the report. That's our annual report at usafacts.org, which we publish for tax season. But the fact that more people are living single, I think, is also interesting. When people talk about, for example, household income coming down, one of the factors I don't think people put in their heads very well is if you have smaller households and more senior households, we will have lower household median household income, even if wages were going up. And at least for the middle 20%, wages are not going up. But government transfers and decreases in taxes are giving more effective buying power to that middle 20%. Let's call that the middle class, if you will.
When you look at this overall and you look at things about climate change and the amount of storms and the amount of money that the U.S. is spending on storms and our education system and healthcare and all these different aspects of life in America right now, do you see it and say, uh-oh, we have some big problems ahead? Or do you say, oh, wow, what great opportunity and hope I look at when I see this report?
Well, obviously, the numbers are the numbers, and everybody can assess them differently. Let me give you an example that I find troubling. The percentage of kids who are proficient in reading at the eighth grade level is up, and some people can be heartened about that. The number is still, I think, 38%, and some people could be depressed about that. Mm-hmm. And so characterizing it as all good or all bad is a little tricky. I hope that number is much higher. Through our philanthropy, my wife and I, we would do all we can to help influence that. And yet at the end of the day, one can be optimistic about the improvements. Greenhouse gas, some people believe the science that it makes a big difference. Some people don't. But if you look at greenhouse gas emissions per person, they're down. The problem is we have more people than we have before. So, you know, it takes context to even decide really how you feel about many of these issues.
Okay. Well, people can check this out at usafacts.org, you said, and we'll also link to it at hereandnow.org. Just while we have you, though, Steve Ballmer, I have to ask you just a couple of things about some of the other big things that you're involved with or have been involved with. First of all, Microsoft, what do you think is your legacy there now, looking back, because you've been gone for a little bit now?
Well, I'd probably highlight three things. Number one, we developed a great successor to me under my watch, Satya Nadella, who's doing a fantastic job. I'm not sure I can take credit, but we really did have the right guy, and we picked him. That's number one. Number two, profits in the company have risen from 20-odd billion, high 20 billions to 40 billion under Satya's watch. But there was a base of profitability that I think has been fundamental to the company's success. And we had the cloud computing thing, along with gaming and a number of the other critical innovations, up and underway, and yet the company's taken them to a whole new level. So I feel good about my legacy, Windows, the enterprise business, some of the Office, some of the things we built in the past, but also the elements of the future. And yet, you know, it's sort of a game of what do you do now? And Satya Nadella and the management team there, I think, has done an outstanding job.
As someone who was a key player in the technology that we use today, do you have second thoughts about how much we use tech? There are people who are addicted to their devices at the expense probably of, you know, personal contact with others, exercise, just general enjoyment of life.
Well, the obsession with the screen can make me nervous. I will say that. Some people will say it decreases personal contact. Some people will say, hey, look, a text is a form of personal contact, and you can reach out and touch many more people than you would. You know, social media, some of the same things. And yet when people always have their head down in their phone, their heads down on their phones, I think that's an issue. I was in a meeting the other day. I was looking up something, and the lady who was presenting said, well, that's rude. You've got your head down and you're on your phone. And I said, well, I'm actually looking up something relevant to the meeting, but it shows It shows some of the issues we face.
Do you ever try to tear yourself away from a screen?
I do. And when I'm not doing it, my wife reminds me that I could be more more social and more interactive.
Okay, one more thing. You also own the NBA team, the Los Angeles Clippers, which lost to the defending champion Golden State Warriors 4-2 in the first round of the playoffs. Your LA rivals, the Lakers, did not make the playoffs. Do you still consider the Clippers the underdog team in LA?
Well, I'd say a few things. We had a heck of a season. I wish it was still going, but you know, made playoffs, took the defending champs to, you know, a little further than people thought. Mm-hmm. Biggest comeback in NBA playoff history. And yet in Los Angeles, the heritage and the history of support is for the Lakers. Do I love that? No, I don't love that. And it's, you know, New York and LA are funny. They're the only two cities where you have multiple teams. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a weird notion to me growing up in Detroit, living in Boston and in Seattle. You actually had to pick. I like our team. I like our positioning. You know, there's a lot of people out there in LA who are a little like our team, resilient, gritty, hardworking, and I'm proud of our team and what it accomplished. And, you know, next year, here's to being even better. And if we're doing a good job with beating all 29 teams in the league, that must mean we're doing a good job beating the Lakers, too. And I get gratification out of that.
Who do you think is going to win the championship this year?
Oh, come on, man. You're just asking me to get in trouble with other owners. Unless I could answer the, you know, the answer could be Clippers, I'll remain silent on that point. Okay. But next year, baby, go Clips.
That is Steve Ballmer, owner of the Clippers, obviously there, former CEO of Microsoft and now head of USA Facts. We've got a link to the new 2019 report at hereandnow.org. Steve Ballmer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy. Really appreciate it.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, EmberWave. EmberWave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. EmberWave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave. Control your comfort.
German automakers have long been famous for their high-quality engineering and manufacturing. But the future of cars is all about software, things like automation and artificial intelligence. And if you want to be a player in that future, car makers are going to need a presence in California's Silicon Valley. Rachel Miro from member station KQED reports.
In a splashy ad that aired during the last Super Bowl, automaker Mercedes boasted about a new Siri-like technology available in its entry-level model.
Hey, Mercedes.
How can I help you?
Change color. Make it cooler. Play my music.
When I'm the A-Class.
Silicon Valley-based SoundHound is the company behind the technology, and Daimler, the parent company of Mercedes, has access to it because it invested in the startup last year. It's a textbook example of a big company buying something fresh from the outside, the kind of partnership Daimler's director of open innovation, Ben Bozer, puts together from the auto giant's 300-plus employee satellite in Sunnyvale.
The world decided that the next revolution will start here, and everybody sent their people here. There's a lot of small companies that are setting up shop and bringing out new innovations, and in that sense, whatever we see here is maybe 2 or 3 years ahead of the curve. It's absolutely mandatory for automotives to be here these days, because this is where everybody is and where everybody innovates, right?
Sure enough, recent reports show the German auto industry is struggling. And not just because of the recent scandals over collusion involving air pollution standards. Some say that's simply the most recent sign of a backwards-facing hubris built on past achievements exporting high-value engineering goods. Sure enough, when self-driving Mercedes taxis take test drives later this year on public streets, they'll be tootling around San Jose, not Stuttgart.
It's hard to believe, especially if you are in the automotive industry and you've been there for decades, that everything could be turned upside down. But even if you just look at the last 10 years and how quickly new competitors enter the market, you realize that it is easier than it ever was. to build a car, easier than it ever was to reinvent certain aspects of the car.
Bowser's getting an assist from a corporate matchmaker of sorts called Plug and Play Tech Center in Sunnyvale. With 27 locations worldwide, Plug and Play maintains a huge global Rolodex of startups. Chief Operating Officer Candace Widows says legacy companies, in Germany and Japan especially, are willing to pay big money to get hooked up with young startups, but also to learn how to work with those little guys so as not to crush their creativity.
There's this cultural element where it's kind of hard to bring change to a large corporation, and this is true in every industry.
Of course, when foreign companies spend time here, they quickly realize you don't have to buy a new idea, you can also copy. Last year, Uber's CEO announced he wanted the company to become the Amazon of transportation, your go-to resource for everything from scooters to flying taxis. This year, Ben Bowser says his company, Daimler, along with rival BMW, announced a $1 billion investment to do the same thing.
Our company has been working in autonomous since 20-something years, so it's not that it's not a new topic for us. But thinking about it as a new business model, that is also a learning curve for us.
There's an old German saying that might help explain why so many foreign automakers have set up shop in Silicon Valley.
Hier sitzen Sie in der ersten Reihe.
Here, you're sitting in the driver's seat. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Myra.
Well, Jazz Fest is underway in New Orleans, so let's do a special Jazz Fest edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
Is that I still love you so.
Joining us today is Gwen Tompkins, executive producer and host of Public Radio's Music Inside Out at WWNO in New Orleans. Hi, Gwen.
Hello. And so nice to talk to you,
Jeremy. It's great to talk to you. By the way, just so everybody knows, yes, you are the former East Africa Bureau Chief for NPR. And what they don't know is you and I have known each other since I was an intern at All Things Considered 20 years ago, Gwen.
That's exactly right.
We used to hang out in Washington.
Yeah, you used to do like really great impressions of other people working at NPR.
Don't tell them that. Wait, they don't know that, but now they do. Okay, maybe for another show. But today we're here to talk about jazz in New Orleans. First of all, tell us, because I haven't been, some people haven't been to Jazz Fest in New Orleans. Tell us about it. It's not just traditional jazz.
Oh, absolutely not. No. The New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival covers such a wide breadth of musical traditions that it's just, you just can't stand it.
And this is the 50th anniversary of the Jazz Festival. Some of the big headliners are Al Green, Santana, Doobie Brothers, Leon Bridges. But you have brought us some more local Louisiana acts. The first one is called Please Don't Talk About Me When I'm Gone. This is by Lars Ettergren featuring Gerald French and Big Al Carson.
Please don't talk about me when I'm gone. Oh, honey, though our friendship ceases from now on. And listen, if you can't say anything real nice, it's better not to talk at all, is my advice.
I'm ready for my beignet, Gwen, when I'm listening to this.
Me too.
Yeah.
Isn't that wonderful? That's Big Al Carson and Lars Ettergren on piano. Lars Ettergren is a traditional jazz pianist born in Sweden who moved to New Orleans in the 1960s and was actually one of the first performers to appear at the first jazz festival in 1970.
Wow.
But, you know, Mahalia Jackson was at the first festival. Duke Ellington was at the first festival. And so what happens when artists pass on, artists who've meant so much to the festival and to the people of New Orleans especially, the festival will actually erect, pieces of art representing those people. They'll actually have ceremonies at the festival. And this is a wonderful traditional song that dates back to 1930. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, the next one that you wanted us to hear is called Vals Balfa, The Bathtub. This is by the Lost Bayou Ramblers. So this is a Cajun band, right?
Exactly. The Lost Bayou Ramblers are probably the best known young Cajun band out there today. And it's comprised of a number of gentlemen, including the Michaud brothers, who are just fantastic singers. And what they do is they honor the Cajun tradition. And Cajun music is very much about Cajun waltzes. So as you can hear, the song is a waltz, mm-hmm. but it's a modern take on the waltz. It's called Vals Balfa, which means the waltz of the Balfa brothers, mm-hmm. Who were, you know, a band that dated back to the 1940s, real superstars in the Cajun tradition.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next, something very different. This is the Zion Harmonizers, an Olympia brass band. This is called Blessed Quietness.
Yes.
What a wonderful salvation, why we always see God's face. What a peaceful habitation, what a quiet resting place.
Oh, blessed quietness,
quietness,
holy
quietness,
what
assurance
in my soul. Then on
the stormy sea,
Jesus
speaks to me,
and the
billows
sea.
So, Gwen, you'd hear this in the gospel tent.
Exactly. And this is real estate at the festival that is unlike any real estate of any major festival in the world. Hmm. The New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival has always had a space for gospel music, always. And that's 50 years, you know. And no other major festival has one. And the Zion Harmonizers have been part of that tradition almost from the very beginning. In fact, the Zion Harmonizers are celebrating their 80th year.
Wow.
Get that, 80.
That
80th
is amazing.
Year
wow.
of existence, yes. And obviously the personnel has changed over the years, but the quality of the music remains. And I'm always a sucker for those beautiful harmonies.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful harmonies. The last one that we have time for today is called Dance at My Funeral. This is by Galactic featuring Boyfriend. So I assume that this is a reference to the very famous jazz funeral that people have in New Orleans.
That's exactly right. It is a very unconventional take on an extremely old and hallowed tradition in New Orleans, the New Orleans jazz funeral. And what's so interesting about it is that, you know, people have been arguing about jazz funerals for generations now. You know, who's carrying on the tradition as we have learned it back from the turn of the last century, and who's continuing that tradition? tradition and who is spoiling that tradition with all kinds of new and iconoclastic efforts, you know? And Galactic right now has great credibility in this town. I mean, they are this incredible funk band that has just bought Tipitina's, which is the most, you know, hallowed ground of clubs in New Orleans. And so they've got the gravitas to be able to try something like this. And Boyfriend, who's a wonderful performer, who's not from New Orleans, and she, you know, I mean, she wrote most of the lyrics. And in many ways, it really shouldn't work. You know, you've got a bunch of white folks talking about jazz funerals, which were not about, you know, I mean, white New Orleanians back at the turn of the last century. And they're doing it in this, like, really kind of, like, shake your, you know, moneymaker kind of way. And, you know, I mean, and it should be really offensive, but dang, it kind of works. It's really fun to listen to, and it's really fun to dance to.
How many times have you been to the jazz festival in New Orleans?
I have not been 50 times.
I did not attend the first
New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, but I've been my fair share, I suppose. And every year it's different. And every year you think you're going to go because you want to see such and such an act. Oh, like this year. Oh, maybe I want to see Pitbull. He's performing, you know. Or maybe I want to see Mavis Staples. She's performing, you know, and she's so great. But then oftentimes it's the act that you hear on the way to the act that you think you want to see that you remember forever, you know. And that's kind of what life is all about, isn't it? It's like you think you're going in one direction, you know, and then you along the way you find something even better.
You do something spontaneous and it works out.
Yeah.
Gwen Tompkins, executive producer and host of Public Radio's Music Inside Out at WWNO in New Orleans. Enjoy the Jazz Festival. Thanks so much for bringing some of it to us.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you. And come on down when you can.
I would love to. And if listeners want to find all the picks from Gwen, you can find them at hereandnow.org. Be transported to Jazz Fest. Also on our Spotify playlist, just search for NPR Here and Now. And we're on Apple Music as well. Holly, y'all better dance at my
funeral. Earlier this week, the CDC reported the number of measles cases in this country has reached a 25-year high. But it is much worse in other countries. According to the World Health Organization, more than 110,000 cases were counted around the globe in the first quarter of the year, a 300% increase over this time last year. And the country where it's the worst, Ukraine, where Dr. Katerina Bulavinova is working on a vaccination campaign for UNICEF. And she joins us now from Kiev via Skype. Doctor, welcome.
Hello, hello.
So there were 70,000 cases of measles in Ukraine in the last year. Compare that to the 700 or so in the United States. Could you give us a sense of the scale of the outbreak where you are?
Yeah, the scale for the moment for 2019, the outbreak is growing, and we have already around 44,000 cases only in this year. And we have also 16 deaths already reported attributed to measles in this year only. So apparently outbreak is growing.
And according to the World Health Organization, only around 42% of babies were vaccinated against the measles in 2016. Is that why you're seeing this outbreak?
We are seeing the outbreak both in adults and in children. And it's very difficult to stop the measles outbreak because it's extremely contagious. And because I have to say that to stop the outbreak, you need to have real consensus in society where everybody agree with each other that this is a very dangerous disease for which you don't have a treatment. And then everybody have to get vaccinated very quick as possible. And then you can stop the outbreak.
In this country, vaccine hesitation is one of the reasons or the main reason why measles is roaring back. It is not a fear that is based on science, but are you saying that in Ukraine, this is also a problem? People are afraid to get the vaccine?
I would say that attitude to people toward immunization is growing better and better, and we see it in the research. However, we have a very interesting issue with the healthcare workers who are not always united in their opinions about immunization and who over-medicalize immunization quite often, making it quite difficult to get this as a service. For example, people are sent to very unnecessary blood tests, urine tests, some consultations consultations of some specialists instead of making this very simple nurse procedure. So it's a bit overcomplicated. And when doctors are so serious about something, it puts more hesitancy in patients.
I see. What about this war with Russia along the eastern border of Ukraine? Has that caused part of the problem?
I wouldn't say so, but obviously for people who live very close to contact line, there is break in services for primary health care because a lot of healthcare workers left. And everything is not that easy. But however, I don't think that it has a big impact. I think bigger systematic issues are having impact. For example, in Ukraine, there is no consolidated decision whether you can go to school or kindergarten being not vaccinated. And definitely schools and kindergartens are now the places where infection is spread because there is a mix of unvaccinated, vaccinated, and then people think that they have, for example, influenza, and then it turns out to measles. So it's about big systematic things.
Hmm. What kind of work are you doing to change that and to get people vaccinated?
First of all, we do big awareness campaigns. We talk to people about it in the most simple language as we can to all different target audiences. For example, recently we started talking to religious leaders in one of the regions of Ukraine. And we were talking to them through their own patient experience, through their own risks being among people. And we work a lot with healthcare providers. And now we would like to focus on universities because it is very important that information on immunization is provided in a correct, evidence-based way in the medical school. Because unfortunately, a lot of medical schools in Ukraine are providing incorrect information on immunization. And basically, young doctors are quite often anti-vaxxers without any good reasons just because they were taught badly.
Well, because your outbreak is so large, it has been blamed for fueling outbreaks in other countries, for example, Israel. Can you explain to people in the United States why they should care about what's happening in a place that seems very far away, frankly?
I actually think that world is extremely small now and people are so much, you know, traveling and you can have direct flight from US to Ukraine. So I think people should take it seriously and traveling to other countries where outbreaks are now get their supplementary additional dose of vaccine, especially measles vaccine, because it's so easy to bring measles to your own country. And if collective immunity is very high, the coverage is sky high, then the size of outbreak in another country will be small, you know, because it will be spreading only in the small pocket of people. But if in your country the coverage is low, for example, like in our country, so if measles comes, then it attacks everybody who is not protected.
That's Dr. Katerina Bulavinova, who's working on a vaccine campaign in Ukraine, the country with the most measles cases during this global outbreak. Doctor, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.